Escalate, guys.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, 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 it is that time again. Time for the worst 90 minutes in soccer podcasting. That's right, it's the Two Guys Soccer Show. And after several weeks of attempting to get this right, we actually have the right two guys on the air. I'm Mike, he's Stead, and for the next 90 minutes, you get the two of us. Just the two of us. Talking soccer on the air, just the two of us. Yeah, I told producer Paul I was going to do that. So, how are you doing this week, Stead?
I'm doing great, doing great. I want to give a quick shout-out to Matt, who has done a great job filling in for the past couple of weeks, as well as to Will, who stepped in and filled in for a little bit. So, you know, the two guys go strong, but every now and then we get a flat tire. It's nice to have other parts that can come in and pick up the slack and keep the show rolling without missing a beat. So, Matt, thanks a bunch, man. We'll get you back on real soon.
All right. So, as always, we are brought to you this week by Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, Maryland's premier venue for sports and live entertainment, and the only place in the Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, where you can catch this Saturday's Rugby World Cup Finals, a rematch of 2007, between England and South Africa, live, bright and early, at 4 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning. You going out to watch that?
No. But I will try to get up and pour myself a nice cup of coffee and see if I can catch it here at the house. I will try to get up for that. I've been able to get the tail end of quite a few games recently, so I'm going to see if I can try to make sure I get up and catch that one.
I hadn't planned on spending a lot of time talking about this, but it should be an interesting final.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got the beauty, the technique of Eddie Jones' England versus just raw power and brute force of South Africa and the Springboks, who have been to the Rugby World Cup finals twice previously and won on both occasions.
Mm-hmm.
So something's got to give.
Mm-hmm.
England, is it going to be South Africa? Who knows? We will see on Saturday. Although I do give the nod slightly to England. They've just been playing lights out over
there. Yeah, you got to give England a legit shot for, you know, the upset over New Zealand. But I'm actually giving the nod to South Africa. So we'll see.
Hey, this is one of those cliches where the immovable force meets the the irresistible force meets the immovable
object. Yeah.
And that is what this final is going to break out to. So, moving on to what actually brings us out this week. I got to say, it was the most uneventful week in football that I can think of recently. You know, it wasn't like there were a ton of great games this week, but it just seemed like lots of interesting stuff happened, the vast majority of it off the field.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually want to start in Spain, where Granada, newly promoted, the little team that could, finds themselves after round 10 in first place in La Liga.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because there wasn't a Clásico this weekend, which was postponed until December as a result of mass protests in Catalan following the sentencing of the leaders of the Catalan independence movement in 2017, most of them receiving 9 to 13-year sentences, and they felt it prudent not to play this game between Real Madrid and Barcelona on this week after all this. What I was thinking about when I was reading this and when I was saying I wanted to bring it up to you is sort of the oddly political nature of this game between two teams who have embraced this reputation for being political without actually being political. And, you know, you've got Barcelona, you know, representative of Catalonia, you know, Más que un club, more than a club. We are the social movement. And then Real Madrid, long with the reputation for being Franco's team in the 50s and the representative of all that was evil following the Franco regime and the Spanish Civil War. And I know you probably haven't read it. I brought it up to you a lot, but there was an interesting book that came out, I want to say about 4 or 5 years ago now, by Sid Lowe, who's a journalist, and an English journalist who covers Spanish football. Really just a great writer, called Fear and Loathing in La Liga. And it goes through that rivalry from the Spanish Civil War all the way up to, you know, like 2014, 2015, up to the Messi and Ronaldo timeframes, and sort of sets them up as opposites and really looks at the way in which these teams have come to represent this and how, you know, Barcelona has dove full head on into being the willing representatives of the rebellion, whereas Real Madrid has kind of embraced without officially embracing this reputation as sort of the team of the establishment, the representatives of Castile. And he looks at it and he's like, you know, it's more a creation of the media and the fans than it is the actual teams themselves. And
right.
Talks about how Catalan was sort of the last bastion to fall to the Spanish Civil War, but that's kind of because by the nature of it, Madrid had to fall first. And how, you know, even in those early days, you know, Real Madrid had guys in their front office who were arrested, who were part of the resistance, whereas Barcelona had leaders who were as much tied to Franco as anybody else. And how, you know,
were you the one telling me that also that Atletico was Franco's team? Because you know way more about this than I do.
Yeah, Atletico was actually the dominant team in the early 50s.
Yeah.
Prior to that, it was like sort of Real Madrid becomes the great team, of course, after they get Di Stéfano. And Barcelona will always tell about how, you know, they had signed Di Stéfano, but then Franco stepped in and all of a sudden the bank, and then they got hosed. But then what we get to tell is that, you know, like one of their players, they stole from Real Madrid right before. So it was kind of like a little bit of revenge. But then Frank, because Real Madrid, and at the time, the early years of the Champions League final, only one team from one country could go. And because Real Madrid went, they won, and, you know, they both couldn't compete. So it became, by nature of winning and being that team that was the representatives of Spain on the European team stage, that's kind of how Real Madrid became Franco's team. They became Franco's team because they won. They didn't win because they were Franco's team.
Ah, got it. Okay. Okay.
And it's just really interesting when you get into, like, sort of the societal, the differences, and then, you know, even how the teams have embraced it. I was looking at it, you know, every year since about 13-14, it seems Nike has put out at least one the kit with the Catalan flag on it for them. Sort of a marketing thing. And it's interesting, like, how almost this sort of, you want to say, like, rebel independence, anti-establishment. It's something in Catalan, but it's seen as almost seditious in Castile and in Madrid, but Nike and Barcelona continue to be allowed to get away with it.
Yeah, you're looking at to you know, as far as the whole with the Catalonia movement too, and how the media has had, and the companies are really pushing this too. You have this whole Catalan national team too that's been around for quite a while, but they've been seemingly playing more games recently, and of course they're definitely exhibitions are more. I wouldn't even call them friendlies. It's more of just like a run and a kickabout for some of the guys to get and wear their Catalan colors. And of course, that's going to continue to be a thing as long as the separatist movement goes on. But I tend to hold on about the state of this rivalry because of you're not going to see, you know, it's like the politics have infected the teams in a way that allows the teams to both capitalize off of it and make a bit more scratch and get a bit more attention on them, which is kind of hard to do when you're Barcelona and Real Madrid. But I don't see the same roots of the rivalry as the Superclásico that takes place in Argentina with Boca Juniors and River Plate, where there really is a team of the establishment, a team of the upper class versus the team of the lower class from the barrios, from the poor districts of Buenos Aires. So there is this real class consciousness and fight, which of course is going to be much more prevalent in areas that had a strong colonial history. But the game in itself, though, is still going to be played, because there's no way either team is going to allow the things that are going on in Catalonia right now to bar them from the biggest game of the season that they happen to have twice. So
at least twice.
So I think this is, it's being unaware fully of the political state in Barcelona. I still think that it's these players love this game and the media loves this game. And hell, I love this game. I got BN Sports so I could watch this game live and not have to watch highlights on YouTube. So it's fun. And I hope that it doesn't turn into something that may lessen the political upheaval going on, because that's a separate issue in itself. And you hope that while that can feed a bit more of the energy into the game, that the game doesn't become bigger than the issues that the people there are actually facing. I think that's the point I'm trying to get at.
You bring up Superclásico, you know, mm-hmm. Boca Juniors and River Plate. There mm-hmm. are other rivalries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I go immediately to the Old Firm.
And I think that's an even bigger show when it comes to like the roots of the rivalry.
This one clearly has its roots in mm-hmm. the Spanish Civil War and the Resistance, mm-hmm. and that those tensions have been long simmering. You know, Catalan doesn't have the relationship with Madrid, with the capital, it's a testy relationship at best.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They want to be an independent country, you know, mm-hmm. it would hamstring because that is the primary economic area. You know, I think if mm-hmm. they left, they'd be one of the they would actually have a larger economy than the rest of Spain.
Mm-hmm,
how
mm-hmm.
just how industrialized that region is. It is
yeah.
the major economic engine. Yes. For
and
the rest
Spain's
of Spain.
Spain's struggling a bit right now economically. They have been for quite some time.
They have their own language. You know, mm-hmm. that's a big one. You know, being forced to speak Castilian Spanish as opposed to Catalan, which
mm-hmm.
is a different language in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of tensions up there. It is different. It's because of the size and reach of the clubs, it's even taken on a political connotation outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading an article a little bit ago about how popular that game was in Kurdistan, in northern Iraq, and how the
mm-hmm.
Kurds have taken to that game and they feel a kinship to Barcelona.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because of that plight, and they see that as being very similar to yours. You talk about
right.
the Catalan national team that plays in sort of, I don't know what it's called. I think it's called like the Stateless World Cup. It's all teams like
yeah.
The Kurds and mm-hmm. like Armenia and stuff like that, places
yeah.
that don't have actual countries, nationalities, but
yeah,
they play
not in any
Palestine.
Or anything. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're never going to see, for instance, Gerard Piqué playing one of those games. He can't.
No.
He loses FIFA eligibility. But they're Catalan nationalists and guys who piddle around the lower leagues who play in those games when they
mm-hmm.
can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But sort of the political connotations, yes, they will get this in. It is too big a game to not be played.
Right.
Even in spite of having to call off the games in 2017, they made them up, they played, and, you know, as I recall, Barcelona went on and won the league.
Won the league,
but
yeah.
It's
mm-hmm.
interesting that, you know, 2 years later, we're back in this situation where the game has to be postponed, and it will certainly be testy in about 2 months when they play it, and you're going to have a couple of El Clasicos in relatively quick succession, potentially,
right.
given
mm-hmm.
how the Copa del Rey and other leagues may play out.
Right. Something to keep an eye on, definitely. Something to keep an eye on. But, you know, and I also, I was tuning in, and I saw Mallorca have at a home game get the best of Real Madrid, and Real Madrid had a red card that game, too. But that was actually really fun to watch, to see one of the minnows, a newly promoted team, at home. And they actually they didn't get an easy goal and then stand in front of the and park the bus. They really outplayed them. So, you know, Real Madrid's got some work to do. And granted, they're also, you know, two wins and they're back on top of the league and they're doing fine. But it was interesting. It was fun to watch. It's always fun for me to watch a lower level team play well. It doesn't even necessarily have to win, just to watch them play well against one of the big dogs in any particular league setting.
It's sometimes it just gets more rare that you see it. I was talking to Matt about this last week, about just how the Premier League we focus a lot on the Premier League because that's the league that we tend to watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier for us to follow because most of the commentary and everything is in English.
Right.
And you don't really have to deal with the translations and stuff like that. Mm. So I just
and
find
the
it
the time
easier.
Of day the game is on is also really beneficial.
Yeah. Mm. And with the money and how big it is, it's just so easy to follow. But the Premier League, the benefit has become that it's just so competitive. So you
mm-hmm.
are able to see more lower teams like a Norwich take points off of Man City than you might,
mm-hmm.
where it's still a surprise to see a Mallorca
yeah.
take points off of a Real Madrid. And I
Definitely.
Think sometimes, too, I think, you know, sometimes there are times where a Real Madrid or a Barcelona think that they can roll into one of these games and they can win simply because of the shirt that they're wearing.
Right.
We've
mm-hmm.
talked about this with PSG, how
mm-hmm.
how much, and it's impossible to quantify, but how much of their struggles in the latter stages of the Champions League are due in large part because of the talent gap that
yep.
exists in Ligue 1.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Marseille are thought to be probably the second best, most talented team in Ligue 1 this right now, and PSG absolutely took them apart
mm-hmm.
4-0 on the weekend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and PSG's already nine. They're already 8 points clear, and they've only played nine. They played 11 games. They're already 8 points clear. It's like, it's. I could see PSG going, hey, we need to get that European 20 Super League that they're talking about going, because the dominance is becoming, it's becoming laughable. And I think for a country, a smaller country maybe like Greece, that has one team that is particularly dominant, and you know they'll win most years, and then every now and then a team like AEK or Panathinaikos can win a league here and there. But for a country like France, which is I believe the most populous country in Europe, where their league has never quite ascended to the level of Bundesliga, Serie A, La Liga, Premier League. I mean, they call it the Big Five, but it's really the Big Four in France. So, and it mainly is in France because of what PSG's been, because what PSG's talent level. So, it's not good, for that league. It's not the talent there. Their best players aren't going to be playing in France. They leave unless they're playing for PSG. So I don't know. I don't know where they go, and I don't know what they do unless they try to just attract more. Because France is a relatively socialist style of economy, so you don't have the big money owners like you can in other leagues, even though a lot of those big money owners that are coming to Europe aren't European-based. A lot of them are American or Middle Eastern, or they'll be from the Far East or something like that who are buying in. So we'll see if one of these other clubs in France can actually get a buyer that can, financial fair play, aside, can inject some wealth into a club that hopefully try and compete year in and year out, because it's going to be coming with PSG's winning by 20 points every year. I think that's bad for the league as a whole. And you see, it's not helping them in Champions League.
It's not helping them in Champions League. I think one of the things is that there's not the same history in France that there is in some of the other countries.
Mm-hmm.
PSG has only really been
in 1970.
Yeah.
Yeah, since 70. Yeah, they're relatively new.
Yeah, they're relatively new. And they got bought and have become something bigger than they were. But there's still just not that sort of revenue in French football, and it's hard to see where it's coming from. Right now, why would I invest money in a Marseille when the only way to make money is to win the Champions League? Because I'm not going to get the domestic contract that a Premier League is going to get. The league just doesn't have that history. It doesn't have that quality. They're never going to get that that $1 billion a year sort of contract that the Premier League gets. They struggle to even get the international broadcasting.
Right.
It's hard to see anybody paying those sums of money, and they need to get that, and it needs to be more than just PSG for it to be compelling. I don't even think you could inject, say, money into Lyon or Marseille and then make it commercially viable both in France and outside of France. Would an NBC, a ESPN, a Fox be willing to spend that much money to get the international broadcast rights to French football if it is just one or two teams?
Right. I think the quick answer is no. I mean, you're seeing how even Serie A missed out on the chance to really have a nice firm foothold in the American market. And, you know, in the United States, as far as, I mean, they're on BN Sports, but that's really not a widely spread channel. And, you know, at least a lot of the other leagues got on with ESPN, especially with the new ESPN Plus app. So that's where you can watch Serie A games, you can watch MLS games and stuff like that, but you can't watch France games on there. So, and Fox, of course, got behind the Bundesliga. So I think the spoils have already been spent for at least expansion over here in North America. And France is going to be on the outside looking in for, I think, forever, mainly for the points that you just talked about, is why would a team invest when they know that in order for them to make money for them to regenerate their clubs and reintegrate into their clubs, it's a reinvest in their clubs, I should say, excuse me, it's probably just not going to be there.
I agree wholeheartedly. So moving on to things closer to home. We've got the semifinals of the MLS playoffs coming up tomorrow and Wednesday. I had NYCFC and LAFC meet in an MLS Cup final. I was wrong. I was right about LAFC. They took care of LA Galaxy, I think, 5-3. Probably, I got to imagine, Zlatan's last game in MLS. And they'll be facing, they'll be hosting Seattle Sounders, who took care of Real Salt Lake. On the flip end, bit of an upset, Toronto FC.
Yes.
Got by NYCFC pretty handily, 3-1. And they'll be taking on an Atlanta United team in Atlanta that beat the Philadelphia Union 2-0. I'm going to give the edge to Atlanta FC in that game. As I said when I was previewing on the other show that I do on Wednesdays, previewing the MLS game, the Union game, it is hard to go into the Mercedes-Benz Arena and play. You know, they're probably going to open up the full thing. You're looking at over 50,000, probably upwards of 70,000. I haven't gotten confirmation that that's what they're going to do. You're playing on that turf field. The dimensions are a little bit different. If you're not used to playing on turf and that style, that field turf, the ball moves differently. Everything is a little bit different. And I think they've got a built-in home field advantage as a result. I personally don't see much getting by LAFC this year. Now, if you have LAFC versus Atlanta United, as I'm predicting, it's two franchises that are in their second and third year who have really shown, again, and I keep saying this, the blueprint. It started with Atlanta United. LAFC picked it up, how to come into the league and compete immediately for championships. Not just compete immediately, but relatively to dominate.
Yeah.
Atlanta United got off to a really bad start, but they've come on, and we've seen just what Frank DeBoer bought now that they've adjusted to his system. They're just running. Bob Bradley has had LAFC humming throughout the course of this whole entire season. And it's going to be interesting as you see teams like Sacramento come in, St. Louis come in, Nashville come in, with big money owners all paying like upwards of $100-200 million for an expansion team. These guys are taking this seriously. Can some of these smaller teams who don't have deep pockets in the ownership really continue to compete? And mostly I'm thinking about Philadelphia Union, who in terms of revenue are towards the bottom third of the league, even though their results put them in very much the top third of it.
I mean, I think we're going to see something similar to what we're seeing in other parts of the world. You're going to, or actually, let's put it this way. You can see the MLS being in the vein of, this is a reach, but just hang with me for a second, but like the NBA, where when you look at the NBA, they talk about small market versus big market teams and stuff like that. But the ownership group and how you attract players is still the most important thing. And while it is a much different game when it comes to the number of people you need in order to be successful, whereas in NBA, you can get two of the best guys and pretty much and be involved late in playoffs every year. Whereas, of course, soccer with 11 players, you need a lot more to work out for you. But in the NBA, though, you really only see about five teams year in and year out that are really have a legitimate shot at making an NBA final and potentially winning. And a lot of it, at least for the NBA, it depends on like really hitting on a draft pick and bringing in free agents. But you're seeing that there is a model specifically for NBA teams to win championships. And if you can't seem to get in that particular circle, you really don't have much of a shot. So let's look at what's happening in MLS, where you brought up Atlanta United and then these new teams that are coming in with big money owners. And there's a model to follow. If you got in and you didn't follow that model, are you going to end up like some of these NBA franchises that you know are never going to win an NBA title, you know, namely Washington Wizards? You know, could you end up in that type of a mold where you have a core group of five teams in MLS, because the league is continuing to expand, that have the lion's share of the talent and the lion's share of the ability to attract players who are maybe didn't quite make it in Europe, but are still top-notch players. I'm speaking specifically of Carlos Vela. Is that going to be the new thing? And what are those teams going to be? I mean, you're seeing now in the West Coast, it's LA, Seattle, and maybe Portland sometimes, maybe not, you know. And then on the East Coast, you're going to see, you know, of course, the New York City teams and Atlanta. But, you know, is Orlando City ever going to truly be able to compete? I doubt it. What about Cincinnati? I don't know. I doubt it. So I don't want to say it's disappointing because, you know, I'm looking at the team that I support and they seem to be stuck in the middle somewhere. But I think it actually, though, as long as you can generate more and more and more interest from people who have deep pockets into the league in general, that's a good thing for MLS. That's a good thing. If you have people who want to invest, who want to get involved, who want to build stadiums, who want to get investors, who want to put on a show, and they're seeing how excited they are for soccer in a city like Atlanta, where actually I didn't think that that was going to be a big soccer hub of a city. I didn't expect that to occur. So there seems to be a blueprint, and I think overall for the league, it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing because I'm actually excited to see a possible final between Atlanta and LAFC. That'll be fun. You have teams that have a combined age of 3. And they're playing for the championship. That would be kind of fun to see. And it'll be in I think it'll be, if it is both of them, it'll be at LA Stadium, a new stadium. They just broke ground in a few years ago. That'll be exciting. And I think it's good for the league. Hopefully they can get more eyes on it.
I tend to disagree with a certain point, because when I look at the teams in the various conference, I see a different blueprint for putting them together.
Mm-hmm.
LA Galaxy is always going to have a star.
Mm-hmm, of course.
They're always, they went from, when you look at it, they started with Donovan. Mm-hmm. Then it was Donovan and Beckham.
Beckham, mm-hmm.
Then it was Stevie Gerrard. That mm-hmm. didn't work out. Now it's Zlatan.
Yeah. They brought in Ashley Cole, too.
Ashley Cole. They've mm-hmm. always had big names. That's mm-hmm. always – that's going to be – they are the Galaxy for a reason. They are mm-hmm. always going to be the stars.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Seattle put together a little bit different. Don't get me wrong. Seattle has money, but that's mm-hmm. a team that, you know, got good when it had Dempsey. They had the
yeah.
money, and they were able to get him in. But a lot of that team has been based on their ability to sign Jordan Morris
mm-hmm.
and Chad Marshall. And that has been a big one for them. You know, mm-hmm. in Philadelphia, you have Moneyball is the best way to put it.
You know? Yeah, the Oakland A's of MLS, basically, yeah.
That's academy, that's mm-hmm. draft picks, that's scouting. Atlanta United, we're going to scout South America. We are going to get guys with an eye to sell who are on the verge of moving to Europe, but looking for an intermediate stop where they mm-hmm. can boost their profile.
Yeah. Well, Atlanta's also smart, too, because they're going to Venezuela, Paraguay, Bolivia, you know, places that have infinite talent but aren't the darlings of South American soccer, where you're going to get most of your talent, mainly speaking of Colombia, Argentina, Chile, Brazil, of course.
And then you have Red Bulls and NYCFC.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to profit based on our linkage to a global brand.
Global brand or a global team.
In both cases, I'm going to go with brand. I think the Citigroup has become more than just Man City. That's a team. You know, Red Bull.
It's blatantly obvious why their colors and their logos look the way they do. I mean,
and it's the same thing,
obvious.
And they make no bones about it.
Yeah, right.
They bought an MLS team. They bought an Australian team because they see those two teams as being potential feeders to grow their brand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Red Bull did the same thing. They just did it first.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, Metro Stars was a stupid name anyway.
It was. And then Toronto, kind of almost like an old school city. We were going to buy players while we had the money to buy it, but we're starting to age a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going to come up next? Now, does that mean that those teams are going to separate? You know, Dallas, FC Dallas, their academy is like legendary.
Mm-hmm.
But where has it gotten them?
It has gotten them anywhere.
You know, Chicago has been in the financial doldrums.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what to make of DC United yet with the departure of Wayne Rooney. You know, mm-hmm. now that you've had the big name European superstar after all those years in exile and RFK, is that where you're going to go from there? And in doing that, the transfer rumors for Mesut Ozil will not go away.
Yeah.
Are you going to build a team more generically? We'll have to see. So I don't know. I think that the tides can change. Certainly, we saw a team like Minnesota go from flat bottom of the Western Conference to the playoffs in a year. So it is capable to grow very quickly. I wouldn't say it's like the NBA insofar as you know where you are going into the season and it's just a matter of where you're going to figure out in the playoffs.
I understand. I was speaking more of a long-term outlook, but I do get what you're saying. I agree. Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I was speaking more of down the line when the league potentially stops at maybe 34 teams. I mean, you could see them doing this. The country's so big, and as the sport on a professional level does, I don't like to compare it to European leagues. I don't. But with the size of the population of the United States, and as the country continues to expand with immigrant populations and second and third generation populations and cities getting more and more involved, you're going to see the league grow. Could you not see a 32 team MLS?
I could see 34 at some point in time.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
that lines up perfectly because that would lead to a 32 game schedule for all the teams playing each one in their conference home and away.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, they like the 34-game schedule, but I could see them going to a 32, and you play, and then you don't have the sort of crossover games. Right now, it's a mess, and I hate the formula because it just makes no sense.
It makes no sense.
I think they've got to get a more consistent one where you can actually judge who's good and who's not. But a 34-team league doesn't seem outside the realm of the possibility to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm with you wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
But changing subjects ever so briefly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Zlatan.
Yes.
He seems to be wanting to go someplace else. And I enjoyed his tenure. I'm upset that I didn't get to see him play.
Yeah.
But Zlatan is that player where you have the – sort of the bombast, but he continues to back it up. And when Zlatan says that Zlatan was good for the league, Zlatan meant that Zlatan was good for the league.
Mm-hmm.
And he came in, he said he was going to score goals. He did that.
Mm-hmm.
I think he probably would have scored more had he gotten better service.
Yeah, agreed.
Came into the league not that long before Wayne Rooney did.
Yeah.
Let's compare their tenures. Who do you think was more impactful on the pitch, and sort of even off of it?
Well, on the pitch, I mean, I think you have to go with Zlatan for both of those, but I will say for a brief period of time, you can say that Wayne Rooney had a bigger impact than Zlatan had at one period of time for his tenure in the league, mainly because LA wasn't in the doldrums like DC United was before Wayne Rooney got there. So I think Zlatan definitely had a better career with MLS, and you didn't see a lot of the depths where, you know, Rooney was still getting in trouble with the airport thing. And then some of his lack of spirit he showed on the field, especially this year, and how it really seemed like he was already before he arrived. where he wasn't as effective on the field. I mean, I can recall being at several games where it just seemed like he was playing because he had to, and he sort of lost his desire to play for the team, and it happened a little too quickly. And whereas you still saw fiery Zlatan, and you know, Zlatan was the player that when he was younger would, of course, you know, get on your nerves if you weren't a supporter of a team that he played for because of his bravado and his arrogance and borderline narcissism. But as he's gotten older and he seems to have this kind of wry smile behind his antics, it's fun. And he was great for MLS off the pitch. I think he was great. You know, we didn't have a player that came in from anywhere and act like that for soccer. I mean, this is behavior you see for plenty of other sports in the United States, but definitely not soccer. And, you know, him walking off the pitch after losing to LAFC and, you know, grabbing his junk and talking trash to some fans. And just, it was funny. I mean, was it appropriate? Well, no, of course not. But was it hilarious? Absolutely. Absolutely. In his interview afterwards, how no one's going to care about MLS after I leave. No one cared before I got here. You know, all of that, like you're not getting the backlash that you would expect a player to get when they say those types of things. It's almost like he was praised for it. And you're hearing, at least the publications I've seen and some of the tweets I've read, it's been like, well, you know, let's all be thankful for Zlatan's contributions to MLS. And they're right. We should be thankful for his contributions. I'm going to miss him. And, you know, I've like slightly become relatively like a fan of his. And it's really, really funny. And is it because I find him entertaining? That's 90% of it. And he scores wonderful goals. And clearly he is outmatched. He outmatches the MLS defenders. They don't know how to cover him. But great goal scoring record. You know, he's got what? He scored 53 goals in 58 games, 58 MLS games. I mean, you got to respect the guy for coming in and doing that. And he's 37 going on 38. He can still play. And, you know, the jokes about, yeah, if Manchester United calls, I'll gladly listen, you know. And I think it's great. I think it's great. I think overall, you got to give the nod to Zlatan.
As you talked, the post-match grabbing of the junk and stuff like that, can't condone. But
yeah, you can't condone it, yeah.
The one thing I will say typically about Zlatan is Zlatan has been a professional.
Mm-hmm.
You get the bravado, but he's a guy who you know puts in the work day in, day out. He could not do what he continues to do if he didn't train as hard as he trains.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
absolutely.
He's going to tell you about it. And he's going to post it. And, you know, I go back a couple of years ago to the picture with Zlatan with the shirt off after the ACL surgery with the picture of King Kong and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And there is this sort of folksiness about it that has become more endearing as he's gotten older. I don't think there is, you know, when he was young, it rubbed everybody the wrong way. Now, when he does it, it's more humorous. And I almost want to say, you almost can see Zlatan in the back saying, I have not changed. You have just adapted to Zlatan.
That's the line of the day. That's exactly right. That's great. That's
Zlatan
great,
has
yes.
not adapted to you. You have just got adapted to Zlatan.
You have, yes, of course. You have decided to enter the realm of Zlatan, and hopefully I will accept you as my loyal subject in my fiefdom.
But it wouldn't make any sense if he didn't deliver.
No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't.
And that's the one – and he's right. You know, I would disagree slightly. L.A. was lost. They were in the doldrums. The only difference – reason why they weren't as bad off – as DC United was when Wayne Rooney arrived, was because they played fewer games. He came sooner.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, but you got to think about it from a more historically. You know, they hadn't. I mean, LA wasn't exactly to doing that much better. No, before he arrived. But I'm speaking for seasons and seasons and seasons. And, you know, after the whole Hadou drama wore off, DC was not competitive. They just weren't competitive. That's what I was meaning of. Like, it just, it was a long time. Those RFK years, those final RFK years were really, really tough for United supporters. So I was speaking about that from that standpoint and bringing in the new stadium.
Okay.
I was speaking about it from there. Not necessarily where they were at that point in the season, but I do agree with you. LA was not playing well either. They were definitely down in the dumps as well. But I think for years, DC was down in the dumps. But to bring in that new stadium and then have Rooney there at the same time and then have that run and then have that great play where he ran down the Orlando City striker and crossed the ball to Luciano to score that goal. I mean, that's kind of where I was like, whoa, what's going on here?
For the first little bit of the first year, yes.
Mm-hmm.
If once that move came, you saw Rooney lose his focus.
Yep.
And it went down. In a way, and that's been the story of Wayne Rooney's career.
Yeah.
Whereas you've always seen pretty much Zlatan be able to maintain that killer instinct, to maintain
right.
that focus, to be able
mm-hmm.
to perform at that consistent level.
Mm-hmm.
You can say maybe the year that he spent in Barcelona wasn't
yeah.
a success, but I would argue, in the words of Brad Childress, it was a systemic misfit.
Yeah. I mean, he still had 21 goals that season.
He still did, but I mean, it just, they were not going to play the way that he played.
No.
And you have to say, when you have Zlatan in the team, you have to play to Zlatan.
Mm-hmm.
But
of
that
course.
Goes with a lot of people. Like, when you have Cristiano Ronaldo in the team,
yeah.
you have to play to Cristiano Ronaldo.
Absolutely.
I don't think that you can have Zlatan and Messi because you have too much finesse on one end and too
mm-hmm.
much of a blunt force object on the other.
Right.
And they just don't fit together.
Mm-hmm.
And that was why you saw him not being able to play, because that's just not his game.
No. No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So I would say, like, I would give the nod overall to Zlatan. I think
mm-hmm.
you will see more Zlatan jerseys because
yeah.
of the personality.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. He brought that sort of bigger than life personality to MLS in a way that we haven't seen it. You know,
mm-hmm.
Beckham was a huge star. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
And he was a great personality.
Yeah.
But in the words of Zlatan, well, in the words of Zlatan combined with Don King, if you didn't have him, you'd have to invent him.
Yeah. Look, man, nobody wanted to watch the World Cup because Zlatan wasn't going to be there. So
there wasn't
you know.
A World Cup because Zlatan wasn't there. It
That's
didn't
true.
Happen.
It didn't happen. That was just an exhibition, of course.
Yes.
Okay, then this is what we need to do. Let's see. If anyone out there in the listening verse, the three people who are checking this show, do me a favor. We need to start a Zlatan sayings meme.
Well,
where
I mean, there was a quiz on BBC.
Yeah.
Did Zlatan say this or not?
Yeah. Perfect.
I scored.
I got to find it.
I got a 9 out of 10 on Zlatan quotes. Because if he, and the key word is you just have to look for Zlatan, because Zlatan only refers to himself in the third person.
Of course, yeah.
If Zlatan says it, then there is no I, it's Zlatan. So,
no.
Anyway, before we move on, I want to give a big shout-out to our sponsor, as always, Flanagan's Hearth and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue for live sports and entertainment. Thank you very much to the fine folks there. Like I said, the only place this year where you can catch the Rugby World Cup live. And then, if you so choose, you can hang around in the morning and watch a little bit of Manchester United and Bournemouth. They'll be open. So, moving on. Still staying in America. Big announcement today. Sergiño Dest, who we talked about at length a couple of weeks ago before the USA-Cuba match, has made it official. He will play for the U.S. men's national team. 18-year-old fullback for Ajax. Quality player, young talent, has nailed down that starting right back role for a young team, Ajax team. We think of it as being a good move. Excited to see where that goes. Now, I've been wrestling with this all day. Earlier today, Matt sent us the text message with the link to the Twitter. And I just don't know how I feel about it. I'm happy that he played, and I'm happy that he made the commitment. Something about the announcement has rubbed me the wrong way, and I can't exactly put my finger on it. It's a tweet. It's got him in the U.S. kit. I'm going to guess that it's like photoshopped on, and it's the quote, "I built up a great feeling with the U.S. over the last couple of years, and I strongly believe in the plans and potential of U.S. soccer." And it's got that whole entire thing. Why is it that we are making a big announcement, almost something like you would see for a marquee free agent signing, for an 18-year-old kid who announced that he has decided that he wants to play for the U.S. men's national team? Should this be a big deal?
It should be a big deal, but it's not. It should be. It should be. I mean, he's a talented young player. Granted, though, he's also 18, going on 19, and he's had really a limited sample size of games to really pull from. I mean, he's sitting on about 20 games, 25 career games total. And how could you? He's a child. And while he has played significant time for U.S.'s, U17, he'll probably get on U23 at some point, unless he just gets a full plug-and-play spot with the national team, which I could totally see happening, looking at the talent and after the recent run of games the U.S. national team has had. But something about this bothers me, too. Because one reason is, why now? You don't have to make a choice at this particular moment. Number two is, it just reeks of a player who knew he couldn't play where he probably really wants to play. And this is an opportunity for international soccer. And of course, I totally understand that being the case, where who doesn't want to have the opportunity to play in a World Cup? And especially is, I can be a, depending on how my career goes at Ajax, I can be a marginal player on the Dutch national team and play in UEFA for qualification, or granted, with qualification changing, the likelihood of the Netherlands getting into Euros and World Cups are significantly higher, or come over to the U.S. and be a potential star, granted you're a star for a very still niche sport in the United States, but your likelihood to play and play on an international stage and be seen by the world is much more likely. So, and I'm putting myself into the mind of him and his family for why they chose to make this decision and why they chose to announce it now. But I don't know. I can't say that the German experiment worked fully. So I don't know. I don't know. Something doesn't smell right to me either. I'll just put it that way. I'm firmly on your team with this one. Something just doesn't seem right.
Well, I'm going to go in the opposite direction. I think that Greg Berhalter and Ernie Stewart, who played in the Netherlands, grew up in the Netherlands, almost the exact same situation as Serginho Destes, right? Child of a Dutch mother and a U.S. serviceman, flew over to the Chelsea-Ajax match and apparently talked to him and his dad after the match. Mind you, we saw the best and worst of Serginho Dest. He absolutely got undressed by Christian Pulisic
mm-hmm.
on that winning goal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking that, you know, he talked to the Dutch national team and they were like, okay, we're willing to let you come in. You can compete for a starting spot, but nothing's promised.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas he probably got more assurances of a
mm-hmm.
spot in the senior national team
mm-hmm.
from the U.S. And there is
mm-hmm.
discernibly a clearer path. He
Absolutely.
Has played youth soccer
youth
all through
yeah.
the ranks
yeah,
with the U.S.
Games. Yeah.
There is a level of comfort and the knowledge. You know, when I look at the roster right now, he's made all of his starts at right back. If you
mm-hmm.
imagine, as I do, that DeAndre Yedlin is the incumbent right back
mm-hmm.
and Reggie Cannon would be sort of his deputy, I can't say that in that conversation and convincing Sergiño Dest that he wants to play, they're going to say, okay, you can compete with Reggie Cannon to back up DeAndre Yedlin. I'm
mm-hmm.
pretty sure they're going to say, he told him, and I would hope he'd be honest with the kid and say, look, right now you're going to play on the left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have nobody on the left.
We don't have a left back. Yeah.
You know, you're going to play on the left. You're going to be in this, and he talked about playing in that core for 10, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
He probably sees himself as the nailed-on starter at left back. Is
mm-hmm.
that the position that he plays most regularly? No. Have we seen fullbacks who can play on either side? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is the bar for American left backs extremely low?
Yeah,
like,
I think you can jump rope over it, you know.
Roberto Carlos or Cafu or,
mm-hmm.
or Dani
mm-hmm.
Alves,
no.
We're looking for the next Steve Cherundolo.
Yeah, we're looking for the next, you know, DeMarcus Beasley.
Can you serviceably play in
yeah.
this position?
Right.
So I think it's a solid move. I said before, if you play for the Dutch national team, I think it's a business decision.
Mm-hmm.
You get the Euros and the World Cup and the
mm-hmm.
qualifying to get the eyes on you. Whereas you're really only going to get the World Cup if you play. I would
Absolutely.
Have respected him if he had said that he was going to go there. It would have been a business decision.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen other players make it.
Mm-hmm.
Giuseppe Rossi. Subotic.
Mm-hmm.
come to mind immediately as
mm-hmm.
American players who are American eligible who decided to play abroad because they thought it was a good business move to make.
Mm-hmm.
I just question the size and the just the scope of this announcement when I just feel like he could have shown up in the roster. And believe me, I'd be shocked if he doesn't start at left back in that game versus Canada. He's
mm-hmm.
coming on and getting tied in the first
yeah.
5 minutes. I don't care
oh,
if he plays
absolutely.
2 minutes in that game and you sub him out for the next 88.
Mm-hmm.
Put the kid in
yeah.
there, get him cap-tied,
yep.
and that's the plan. You don't
mm-hmm.
make an announcement for somebody like that that you plan to put on the U23 roster.
Mm-hmm.
Will he play in the Olympics? That's a possibility, but he
yeah.
has to have some assurances that he's going to play with the senior men's national team.
Absolutely.
And get the bulk of his playing time with the senior
mm-hmm.
men's national team.
Mm-hmm.
And at 18, that's a good look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. Mm-hmm.
I can't put my – it just seems like it's a bit too much right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great attention because, you know, this is what everybody's writing about rather than talking about, you know, U.S. soccer was smart. They did this in the morning. That gets the conversation focused on soccer and away from Greg Berhalter and the failings.
Mm-hmm.
And then they announced the new U.S. women's coach in the afternoon.
I missed that. Who they announced?
Vlatko Andronovski.
Yeah, I'm not going to act like I know who that is.
I don't care. We have a coach named Vlatko. he used to be the coach of FC Kansas City and then Seattle Reign.
Okay.
He's the coach of the year. Really highly thought of in the NWSL. It's just
okay.
interesting that as much of a machine as the U.S. women's national team is, and apparently he's like really highly thought of and really considered to be a great developer of talent in both developing youth talent and getting star players to play at a level above.
Mm-hmm.
He has absolutely no international experience at any level.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking him up right now. Okay, wow,
he's
yeah.
Young,
yeah.
43.
And he's young, you know, 43. He's a young guy.
He's never coached college. He's never he's coached NWSL, no international experience, not even an assistant coach in the women's setup, which is, makes it very interesting that they would go in that direction, given the expectations on U.S. You know, he's going into an interesting cycle where they're going to try and bet in a new coach at the same time that they're going to be competing with for a gold medal. Oh, yeah, Crystal Dunn looks like she sustained a pretty serious ankle injury.
Oh, wow.
In the NWSL finals. And who's the young forward? Who I can't just announce. One of the girls just announced that she was pregnant.
Oh, I don't know. I truly don't know.
Her name just slipped me as I look it up. But it just an interesting hot. And so the Alex Morgan just announced that she's pregnant. So she.
Oh yeah, I saw that. That's right. I did
right
see that. Yeah, I saw that on Reddit.
Right before the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of a team that's in transition.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see that move. So as we go into the last half hour of the show, it's time to turn our attention to what we like to talk to most.
Mm-hmm.
Weekend that was a weekend in the Premier League.
Yes.
But I don't necessarily want to talk as much about, you know, the results as just some stuff that happened around.
Yeah.
VAR is failing. And
This
weekend was evidence of it. You had multiple penalties that weren't.
Mm-hmm.
A goal that probably should have been.
Yes.
And somebody has to explain how David Silva scored that goal for Manchester City off of Kevin De Bruyne's free kick. Because if he does get a foot to it, Raheem Sterling's offside and interfering with play.
Mm-hmm.
If he doesn't, then it's Kevin De Bruyne's goal. But somehow VAR managed to get it so that David Silva scored a goal. But Raheem Sterling, who was obviously offside when David Silva touched it and interfering with play, wasn't. So we have come to a point now where VAR has made a guy invisible.
And on top of that, you have VAR that has – I feel like VAR has changed the interpretation of things like, you know, incidental contact, players 50-50 balls and stuff. It seems like that's now no longer a thing. And I'm speaking mainly of the disallowed goal for Arsenal against Crystal Palace due to a foul on Callum Chambers when Callum Chambers hit the ball and a Crystal Palace player fell on top of him at the same time his legs are tied up with the player who was not in possession of the ball. So, again, the interpretation of the rule is, I don't know what, I'm not going to sit here and act like I know exactly what the rule is, but it seemed like now VAR is, I mean, this is going to sound so childish, but I don't care. Is VAR looking to disallow goals? I mean, you're seeing a lot of disallowed goals due to VAR. And I you know, it's the whole thing is like, well, has any game been detrimentally changed due to instant replay or VAR? Because it's basically instant replay to it being, or are they actually seeing and identifying things which they didn't see and identify the first time? It doesn't look so to me. It looks like you have refs now not really making decisions about things, and you're having marginal calls going, you know, we're not really sure, so we'll just take the goal away in one game, and the next game you're not really sure, and you give the goal. You understand what I'm saying? It's just it's a lack of consistency, which we were talking about earlier this year, was a lack of consistency with VAR. So I don't really know what to make of it. I really don't.
I was led to believe that VAR wasn't going to overrule the judgment of
exactly. I was under the same impression.
Or that VAR was how it was in the Confederations Cup when it was first introduced, which was,
mm-hmm.
hey, boss, come over here and take another look at it.
Right. Right.
But now you're clearly having calls made by VAR officials.
VAR, yes.
And I can think of, and I'm going to take two penalties that both happened to Man United.
Mm-hmm.
In one game, I want to say it was Southampton. It was a game you and I were watching. There was a clear-cut penalty on Gary Cahill.
Yes.
Right? And he should have been penalized, and he should have gotten a red card. But the ruling on the field wasn't that it was a penalty. But when we looked at it, it was clear. But
mm-hmm.
VAR didn't overrule the ref. Let's play. This time, it is clearly not a penalty.
Mm-hmm.
You got two guys going for the ball. Daniel James leans into the defender. The defender leans back into him. Daniel James creates the contact that causes him to go over, and VAR then gives the penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the pendulum keeps swinging on the interpretation, and they just haven't figured out how to keep it from going and just keep it centered. So before you had it where VAR was not overruling refs when they should have. Now I feel like VAR is overruling refs when they shouldn't.
Yes. Yes. Completely. Completely. You've seen in the Rugby World Cup too, where their replay system is very strong, and they basically say, nope, that's a penalty. And the ref goes, yep, that's a penalty. Let's move on. Let's keep the game moving. And again, VAR doesn't seem to have what's the identity going to be? Is VAR another set of eyes that acts as an official, or is VAR like what you said, is like, hey boss, can you come check this out again? Just in case you wanted to double check. Cause we also saw, it seems like they're more likely to give some yellow cards for diving. We saw Zaha get a yellow card for diving in the box. Now, it looked like a pretty clear penalty to me in the first place. But then a yellow card was given for diving, but then you saw VAR and they gave the penalty. So it's like, okay, VAR was used properly in that situation, I guess. But again, Martin Atkinson didn't go look at a screen or anything. He basically just had it in his ear, and they're like, oh, no, that's a penalty. Give him a penalty kick. Like, wow, a penalty kick? That's basically you're giving him a goal. So it just seems like it's too powerful. It's just too strong to change outcomes of games where you have a penalty given. And then, but then of course the previous game where, I think Saku from Arsenal was given a yellow card for diving when there was clear contact and VAR showed contact. So if VAR wouldn't be under so much scrutiny if it was consistent, but it's just not consistent. It's so inconsistent that it's leading for people to say, well, what is this? Because it's not working in the way that you told us it was going to work.
You bring up the Rugby World Cup. You see this in cricket.
Mm-hmm.
The way that you can listen into the replay official
mm-hmm.
and the ref.
Yeah.
And your communication.
It's all get out. It's transparent.
And you see them, okay, this is what I'm seeing. I'm looking to see if the ball is down. Okay, rewind, yes. And you see this clear. I think people would be more settled if you could hear that sort of communication.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're ready for it because I don't think that the FA did a good enough job with sort of communicating the use of VAR to the officials
mm-hmm.
ahead of time and what the expectation is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see in the preseason in NFL football, the refs will be upfront about in the Referees Association, here's how we're going to call. This is what we're looking for right now. We are going to call this. And then it levels off. I would like it if, like you said, what is the purpose of having a replay screen on the side if the ref on the field is not going to use it?
Right.
If VAR's reviewing a play and you can clearly see Martin Atkinson in the center of the field with his finger up to his ear listening to the talking, he's not looking at the play, talking it over with the replay official.
Right.
They should have some sort of communication between the two of them to say, okay, this is what I'm seeing. What are you seeing?
And that, I think that's the part that's most disturbing. And I like the fact, though, that I really wish more people could see how this Rugby World Cup is doing it. Because number one, it's great to see the communication between the players and the referee. You don't see a lot of the dissent that you see in most other sports as you do in rugby. But you see the official go to the player and go to the team captain and fully explain what the infraction was and what the next steps are going to be. You don't really you see the soccer official take the ball, run down to the field, do the little symbol, point, put the ball down, and basically just kind of run away. And then you have the fourth official on the sideline who has Jurgen Klopp standing over him, just berating him. And while watching Jurgen Klopp yell, it's always going to be entertaining. That's not what this is. I really don't think this is what this was intended for. So it's until
I think
they
the other
actually,
difference, though, is that in rugby, as in cricket, the mics are hot.
Yes.
All right. So when you you have you hear.
Yeah, you
not
hear.
Not just
clear.
In the stadium, you hear what they're saying.
Yep.
And I think that lends a level to it because the players, like, we can lip read and stuff like that, but they know, like, okay, I got to be on my P's and Q's because everybody is going to hear what I'm about to say.
Right. Right.
And you'll hear them.
Yeah.
Okay, back up. Back up. That's a penalty. Yep. That's a penalty. Mm-hmm. All right, that's a penalty. And everybody hears it.
Yeah.
That level,
yeah,
I think even that level of transparency would be good for soccer. But we talk about VAR and Tottenham, as it affected Tottenham, Arsenal, and Manchester United. And the top three, the top four this week, relatively unchanged. In fact, starting to open up a little bit of separation.
Right.
You know, you got City in second on 22 points, and then Leicester and Chelsea sitting on 24 points ahead of Arsenal. With one win, Manchester United jumped from 13th to 7th. With one draw, or one loss, Tottenham fell from 7th to 11th. Shows you how tightly packed those teams are.
Yes.
But in those three teams, you have teams that even recently just feel like they're trending in different directions.
Yes. Very much so. I feel like Spurs are – they've been – I think after maybe the first few weeks of the season, they've pretty much been stuck in the muck a bit, and they can't seem to break out. And for all the burying we were doing of Manchester United, which was quite humorous, but their talent can't be denied. And you're looking at Manchester United, if they have one more weekend where the teams above them decide to not play all that great, they're back in fifth place.
Well, and they have a nice little run of fixtures.
Yes, they do.
I was talking to Matt about this. And I said, over the next couple of weeks, you're going to see what these three teams are. You know, Arsenal have Liverpool in the FA Cup.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the league, they host Wolves.
Mm-hmm.
They're away to Leicester City.
Mm-hmm. And they're home to
Southampton.
Mm-hmm.
Before December.
Yeah.
Tottenham are away to Everton, who
mm-hmm.
are shipping goals for fun.
Yeah. I don't know what's wrong with that.
Home to Sheffield United,
mm-hmm.
and then away to
West Ham. Yeah.
The West Ham game should be tricky.
Yeah.
You would figure that they should be, if they're in the right stead, good enough to pick up wins.
Mm-hmm.
Manchester United, away to Bournemouth, home to Brighton,
mm-hmm.
away to Sheffield United,
mm-hmm.
and then home to Aston Villa.
Mm-hmm.
If United are a team that has European aspirations, they should take all 12 of those points.
They should.
If they are a team that is in the bottom half of the league fighting against relegation, they will struggle.
Mm-hmm.
But by December, we will know the direction that they are headed in.
Mm-hmm.
We will know where Arsenal stands, because
mm-hmm.
if they are a team that has designs on finishing in the European places in the Champions League, then they will handle Wolves. They will beat
mm-hmm.
Leicester City.
Right.
They will beat Southampton.
Right.
And they should take Norwich. The same with Tottenham.
Mm-hmm.
Now, given the trends, you could see Tottenham dropping points in that run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, based on
the Arsenal,
last...
yeah, but you could see Arsenal dropping points as well. I mean, it's at Leicester. That's like they could go in there and lose 3-0 easily.
They could
easily, especially with the way that defense gives up goals. And you know, Wolves may not be winning to the clip that they were last year, but they're not losing either.
Mm-mm.
They're drawing. They're getting draws, and they're winning Europa League games. Wolves is getting their feet under them. So, and, you know, Wolves is not afraid to go in any stadium and play at all. They don't seem to get that big game shake when you go into Emirates or go into, you know, Eastlands or go into Anfield. They don't seem to get those jitters. So, I don't know. And look, Arsenal is a team right now with no identity. They have the potential to have the best offense and the best three-striker attack in the Premier League. And yet, they don't have the midfield to service the ball properly. And the defense, we've talked about them all year. At least they're finally playing Tierney, but they still aren't playing. Hector Bellerin still isn't back from injury. And I'm going to bring this up. I don't understand the why Granit Xhaka is given the level of leadership that he's been given by this team, and apparently this is what the players want. I don't see that, but to see him walk off the field and jeer the fans, who, you know, fans are fans. If you're the player, you got to know they weren't throwing bottles at you. Just walk off the field and go sit down and handle it like a man. And he didn't. He handled it very, very poorly. He sounded like looked like a child, and he was cupping his ears, and then he rips his shirt off, throws it on the ground, and walks off the pitch completely. I'm sorry. If you're the team captain, you have to be able to handle that. You have to be able to handle that. And you're also – this isn't necessarily behavior that he hasn't displayed before. He's on 29 yellow cards for his Arsenal career. 29 yellow cards. So – Arsenal has to clean house a little bit. They need to start rethinking the way they're doing this. And the fact that you're not playing Ozil, because Ozil doesn't track back and play defense, but so you're playing defensive-minded players in offensive positions, so yet you have your three-headed monster, which could be a huge monster, is basically just standing there waiting, and you have Lacazette and Pepe standing there in between, in the defensive third of the field way too often. So Arsenal doesn't look like they, I'm sorry, they could be in eighth by the time December rolls around. They could easily be in eighth place. I would not be surprised.
I think I got a message from a buddy of mine, Sean, over in the UK, who's
mm-hmm.
a diehard Arsenal fan, and he said he said I've never seen a Arsenal captain walk off the pitch, take his shirt off. It's been crazy the number of people over there who want his head.
Yeah.
And it just seems in the body language surrounding those three teams that they're trending in different directions.
Absolutely.
You know, United getting healthy, getting confident. You can see it in the way that they were playing against Norwich that
and Liverpool.
And even Partizan. That is starting to come together for them.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, in Arsenal, you have Xhaka, your coach, your captain, behaving like that. And it's just the drama that has seemed to inevitably surround Arsenal the whole season, from Kolasinac and Ozil in the beginning of the season to this, to, you know, Unai Emery coming out last week and saying, like, it's a institutional decision to no longer play Ozil. Meanwhile, on the other side of North London, Spurs just look lost. And I consciously didn't bring Carlos on because I don't want to rub it in that sense that, you know, it's a team that just over the course of since September, I mean, they picked up 7 points in September, which, you know, coincidentally, Man United has picked up 8. So it's not like United are doing that much better.
Yeah, but United aren't coming from the season that Spurs are coming from last year or with the expectations that they had. They were expected to finish third and compete for the title this year. That's what they were hoping for. And while I didn't think that was necessarily possible, we were basically saying at the beginning of the season that it looks like you had a two-team race for the title. You had Spurs solidly in third, and then you had three teams competing for Champions League spot and Europa League spot. Now it's looking like you have the top four. It basically looks like they're going to be pretty secure. Leicester does not look like they're on some fluke run. They are a solid team. And playing for fifth place? That's what it looks like right now.
I still think there's something about me that is still just willing to bet against Leicester in the long run.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I get it. I do.
I just feel like there's enough in one of those three teams to get it together, but it's going to be who gets it most consistent heading into December. Mm-hmm. And this November stretch, this next month, I think is horribly interesting because I think it really is going to show how it takes shape. You know, before you get into that holiday period, which is inevitably going to be absolutely nuts, where you have teams playing like 4 games in a week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I was looking at it. Manchester United play on the 26th, and then they turn around and play on the 28th.
Yeah, so is Leicester.
Yeah, and it's nuts. And the run-ins and who's got the easier run-in and where it's going to be setting up. And it sets up nicely. You know, it's just these trends over the last couple of games, you know, you're starting to feel like maybe United might be trending upwards. Now, that could all come crashing down over the course of the next week. They are one bad performance against a team in Bournemouth who's going to bunker in against them.
Yeah.
From being right back down in the doldrums. Just like Tottenham could easily go to Everton and win 5-0 the way that Everton's been playing defense this year.
Right.
You know, Chelsea could get that win against Wolves, and we're having a completely different conversation. So I'm not going necessarily for hot takes as much as I am to say, you know, right now off the strength of it, it just looks like these teams are trending in opposite directions.
Yeah, agreed.
And who's going to be able to steady the ship heading into the fall the best? Who's going to be able to take advantage of this run of fixtures that are eminently winnable for all three of them?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And pick up the points.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And you know, Leicester's going to have a very difficult December. They're playing Liverpool and Manchester City back-to-back. So the – yes, Leicester could obviously crack and fall back down a bit more. But it's just difficult for me to have any real confidence in Arsenal's ability to get it together. Because even when they were third for the couple of weeks, I think they're the worst third-place Premier League team I've ever seen. And they're – their good form has, when they are in good form, it seems to be because the other teams that they're playing against just aren't playing well. It's not necessarily that they are dominating or they are imposing their style or their abilities on the other teams. And if it wasn't for Aubameyang and Leno, I have no idea where they would be right now. They'd probably be sitting in 14th place. So to have dependence on two players of that making so early into the season, and, you know, Lacazette is being hurt coming off of injury, it just doesn't seem possible. Now, they could, yes, of course they could win a couple of games, but you're just looking at, we're talking about trends and trending up and trending down. You're looking at the teams that Arsenal has to play against, and they tend to be trending in a more positive direction versus the teams that Manchester United and Spurs are going to be playing. So it seems like if any team has a chance to move up, I think I definitely see Manchester United continuing to at least over the next couple of weeks play well. I expect Spurs to get it together. I just expect them to. But I don't see it for Arsenal. So I really hope I eat my words, because I've eaten my words quite a bit this year. In fact, I have to eat my words from the prediction I made for Man U Liverpool a couple of weeks ago. But it just doesn't look good for Arsenal right now.
So as we wrap up, I want to give a big shout out to Christian Pulisic with perfect hat trick. Right foot, left foot, and header.
Damn right. Yeah.
And
definitely.
I guess our last sort of off field has been the different sort of the reaction. Again, Sean texted me. He was like, you know, how are you feeling about your golden boy? And I was like, you know, yes, I'm happy that he's getting a run. His success is good for the men's national team, but he's still 21 years old.
Yeah.
You know, he's a 21-year-old kid. I have said multiple times on this show, he is not a scoring winger. And he was pointing out, like, the difference in expectations, and the BBC did a good job of this. You know, like, ESPN has an article every Saturday dedicated to what Christian Pulisic did or did not do. Why isn't Lampard playing him? Why isn't Lampard playing him? Meanwhile, in Chelsea, it's like he's behind Callum Hudson-Odoi
and
Willian.
Yeah.
And guys who are actually Frank Lampard's guys.
Yeah.
Right? Who he has a relationship with.
Right.
He
played with a couple of them, too.
Yeah, you know, he didn't know Christian Pulisic. Christian Pulisic had a full week off in between the end of the Gold Cup and the start of Chelsea training. And perhaps we're seeing him come good and we're seeing him add another facet to his game. But remember, he only went for $58 million. This was a kid who got Wally pipped by Jadon Sancho, who's going to be worth double what he's worth.
Absolutely. But look at this. Look at Chelsea's squad. I mean, I don't think anyone who knows – I mean, clearly the ESPN articles are clickbait, and they're just trying to get people to tune in and read something on their website, because it really makes no sense. It really doesn't. You can't compare him to Mason Mount, who has I believe he was an academy player at Chelsea, who's been with the squad since 2005. And, of course, he's going to be getting more run than Pulisic is. Be happy that he's on the squad. Be happy that he's making strides to be on the first team. But, no, absolutely not. And anyone who is like, why he should be playing, you really don't know what you're talking about. You really don't know. He's the best American player right now, yes. That doesn't really mean anything. I don't think
it's
you had to just mention,
sort of like being the world's tallest midget.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I don't think you had a bunch of people from England wondering why the Bulls weren't starting Luol Deng when he was playing playing basketball. So it's, you know, calm down.
So as we depart, I want to give a big shout out to Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, our sponsor. Thank you for keeping us on the air, 4844 Cordell Avenue. A big shout out to producer Paul once again, keeping the trains running on time as he always does each and every week. And a big shout out to the Tampa Bay Philadelphia Eagles Club down there, the only Philadelphia Eagles supporters club in the Tampa Bay area. Parting words from you as we leave this podcast coil.
Yes, I hope my bad luck from the World Series doesn't affect any other team I support. I've never thought I would see a day when, after five games of the World Series, we've had the road teams be 5-0. Just so happens that DC has to lose three of them. So Don't watch the World Series.
Ersatz. E-R-S-A-T-Z. Simulated or imitation. Describing an artificial substitute for something usually of inferior quality. Kind of like the Washington Nationals pitching.
Bullpen.
Thanks again to both of our listeners. We did horribly this weekend. Nah, we did all right this week. We'll try and do better next week. Once again, this has been the Two Guys Stalker Show. For Stead, I am Mike. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.